Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is Thursday, April the 17th. This is episode 3,658 of the Survival Podcast. This is Expert Counsel Q&A show for this week, because we are up to a Thursday, and I got a really cool lineup of people, also some really good announcements as well. Number one, is Trump going to send actual American citizens to an El Salvadoran prison? He said some things that kind of alluded to that. I don't think this is even possible, let alone probable. But there's another part of this, and I completely agree with Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams in this segment, that is untenable. You cannot send an American citizen to El Salvador prison. Now, the kind of people that they're talking about doing it to at first, I really don't give a shit what happens to them. But you can't do that, because then it becomes possible to do it. Like, that's how it always starts, right? But there's another thing that they bring into this segment, they lead off with it, and that is the deportation, and I guess technically that would be the right word, but the deportation of students here on student visas that are actively protesting on college campuses. This is one of those places where I do not completely agree with Dr. Paul or Dan or Chris over there. But we don't have to agree all the time, and I'll give you kind of my take on that. I mean, I just basically out of the gate think that being in a country that is not your own on a student visa is not a right. The right to speak is a right, but you do not have a right to be here in the first place. So we have every right as a nation to stipulate the things that are unacceptable in order to have a visa, to be in this country long term, to go to our school. And why are we? I got another problem with this altogether that has very little to do with the issue at hand for Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams in this, and I'll bring it up in my rebuttal to that. Then I have a twofer for you. I guess that's what you'd call it. Twofer is usually two subjects. This is one subject to experts independently answering it so you can contrast them. This has to do with money. This is about someone who has an awful problem. Their business has done so well that they have given themselves a raise. They are making really good money right now, and they don't want to waste it. And they're not going to spend it just not to pay taxes. But they don't want to, miss ways that they could maybe be creative with tax structuring. And then, but at the end of the day, they're just going to simply have surplus capital. What should I do with it? So I sent this to Matt Sersley, who is an agorist tax advisor. And then I also sent it to John Pugliano, who, of course, is good with all things money. And I bet you they're going to have some very similar and some differential advice. And I thought it would be cool. So when we get to that segment, I'll just play it straight through. I'll play John first and Matt second. Then we're going to hear from Andy McCann on strengthening your back. He's got a couple links to go along with that. They are in the show notes. And then, how do you know when you look at a foundation of a house and you see a crack? Is it just like a hairline crack? Is it a crack, but it's really not a problem? It's not really because the foundation is failing or the earth underneath it is settling or rising. It's just a crack and it's not really going to go anywhere. Or this is a serious problem and you may be looking at having, piers, and like it could be a very expensive recovery, repair process, or even just preventive process to keep it from failing worse. How do you know? Well, Ryan Steva, who is the Homestead Consultant, but also a licensed home inspector, we'll talk to you about that. Chef Ken Daniels, we'll talk about one of my favorite things in the world. Well, cooking, obviously. I love to cook. But one specific thing, the maitake mushroom, also known as hen of the woods. And I am so jealous of you people that live in the northeastern United States, because this was a go-to for us every fall when I lived in Pennsylvania. Because once you find where these things exist, when you go back there next year, they'll be there again, and they're big. I remember my uncle and I literally, no exaggeration, filling up a truck bed of these things one time and going bar to bar through all the little towns, Minersville and Llewellyn, et cetera, up there in that area, Pottsville, et cetera, and just going in and selling these things with a scale and putting it right on the bar and selling them for $10 a pound and making a few hundred bucks and still going home with a ton of mushrooms. And they are rare as heck, guys, in the market. and they are tough to cultivate in artificial conditions. It can be done, but it's not easy. They sell for a lot more than $10 a pound. In fact, even back then, we're talking the 80s, they sold for more than $10 a pound in, like, you know, lucrative bougie places. But that was about as much as you get from, you know, Pennsylvania rednecks. But it was a great mushroom. And I was like, I wonder how he's going to say to do this. And he nails it perfectly. And I'll tell you a place when we get to that segment that I go to about once a year, maybe twice a year if that, because of cost, not because of quality, where they make them with the dish that I order, and they do it exactly the way he talks about. And then I'm going to talk about the super battery that really exists but will never even power something as simple as a smartphone. This is going around all over social media, specifically right now, Facebook, right, is just going nuts with talking, stories and sharing. Oh, my God, look, it's a super battery. It lasts 50 years. 50 years. Oh, 50 years? You can charge it over and over for 50 years? No. You put it in the device, and the device will run continuously for 50 years. Well, I saw that and thought, wow, and people started talking about it. My cell phone will never die. Something didn't ring true, so I went and looked it up. It exists. It's real. But the hype is complete BS. This is really not going to be about the battery itself, but how to effectively use ChatGPT or another AI unit to discern, is this thing what it looks like it is or not? In this case, it is not that the technology doesn't work. It's not that the technology isn't real. It's not that the claims are not doable. It is the cost. It is the cost. And the one that they made is so tiny, it does so little, and it's still very expensive. Well, we'll get to it when we get there. But again, it'll take me just a few minutes to explain to you why the hype doesn't match the reality. But then we'll be able to use that as, this is how you use AI. Because you could have very well used AI to verify this claim and found out that it was true and thought, oh, wow, great. It's how you use a tool that makes the tool effective. With that, let's go ahead and drop on in here from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on a bunch of issues that are quite contentious.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing here is a convergence of two things. Now, the first is what we've seen over the past couple of months, which is the administration, through the person of Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, deporting foreign students in the United States, not accusing them of a crime, although they were first promised, Trump first promised that violent foreign students in the U.S. protesting violently would be sent away. Most Americans thought, okay, that's probably not a bad idea. But now the people that actually were sent, they've not committed crimes, they've not even been accused of committing crimes, but they are against our policy toward Israel, or the administration's policy toward Israel, which is protected speech. Anyone can be opposed to our policy in the Middle East, American or foreign, and are allowed to express it under our First Amendment. So you have this on the one hand. You have deporting students for doing nothing other than expressing themselves politically, and then you have these deportations of illegals, admittedly illegals here in the U.S., to a prison in El Salvador. Now, what seems to be happening is that these two things are converging to where President Trump is saying, I like the idea of sending people away, and I want to start doing it with Americans. And that was a shock because people didn't believe. They thought, is he joking? Because he says some pretty outlandish things. No, when the president of El Salvador was in town this week, he openly raised the issue of sending Americans. Now, let's listen to this first clip. Here is President Trump bringing it up in his own words, his interest in sending American citizens to foreign prisons, including the notorious prison in El Salvador.
You mentioned that you're open to deporting individuals that aren't foreign aliens, but are criminals, to El Salvador. Does that include potentially U.S. citizens, fully naturalized Americans?
If they're criminals and if they hit people with baseball bats over their head that happen to be 90 years old, and if they rape 87-year-old women in Coney Island, Brooklyn, yeah, that includes them. Why do you think there's special category of person? They're as bad as anybody that comes in. We have bad ones, too. And I'm all for because we can do things with the president for less money and have great security. And we have a huge prison population. We have a huge number of prisons, and then we have the private prisons, and some are operated well, I guess, and some aren't. But he does a great job with that. We have others that we're negotiating with, too.
So you establish that you can send people away for having the wrong views on the Middle East, and then you also establish that he wants to send Americans away. How long is it before that happens?
I am amazed that they can do this and not assume responsibility, that we could just pick them up and shift them away. But unfortunately, I see that as domestically already happening to some degree when you see people arrested and held for months, if not years, and American citizens that were never proved, they didn't have their day in court, they were never proven to have committed a violent crime. Well, whether you're in El Salvador, in a bad-looking prison here in this country, it's still pretty vicious penalties.
That's a good point. I think that's one that Trump supporters are missing. Yeah, you can still support Trump, but those of us who were, and we were consistently opposed to the treatment of the January 6th protesters, we thought it was terrible that they were sent away without due process. Well, you have to be consistent. You have to be concerned about due process in this. Even if they are bad guys with a lot of bad tattoos, you still have to be concerned about this.
So let me say again, I feel like these are two totally separated issues here when it comes to power of government questioning. And again, you guys know me. If I had my way, we would have a stateless society. But we don't. And therefore, we are not immune to the consequences of ignoring that reality. And so here's how I'm coming at this with the student visa thing. I don't believe that any person anywhere in the world, and I don't give a crap if they make Mother Teresa look like Al Capone. No one from any country outside of the United States borders has any right, okay? I didn't say they don't have any ability. They do not have a right to come to the United States long term to pursue a degree. It is, in fact, based on the way the world works, an effing privilege. And we have, as a nation, the right, I said right for the nation, to specify at any level, at any requirement that we want to require in order to issue that visa, to allow a person to stay here for four or more years to obtain an education in the United States. I also feel that program is extensively abused around the world, and it is used to collect information on American citizens. Basically, espionage is how it's used. That's not what's going on in this particular instance, but it is how it is used. And it has a history of being used that way. And if our government says you cannot be engaged in these activities and receive this piece of paper that says you're allowed to stay here and you're from, I don't care where, this is not even country specific to me, and they take that piece of paper away from you, you have to leave and I don't want to hear you cry. You do not have a right to free speech that exceeds your privilege of having the visa. This is a very simple thing. If I got a student visa when I was young and I had gone to, let's say, at that time it would have still been the Soviet Union, but let's say a couple of years, I was in my 20s, right? Maybe, you know, it happened in my teens that the Soviet Union broke. Let's just say, though, I was like 22 years old and it was that was clearly, you know, shut down and done. Things were different. It wasn't even quite the communist hellhole that it had been all the years that I was growing up. And I went to Russia. And I went to Russia on a student visa, and while I was in a Russian college, I started protesting against Russia. They would probably pull my visa and send my ass home. And you know what people would have said? And they would have been right. Well, you're the one that went to Russia. You're the one that went to Russia. If you go to Russia on a student visa, you don't get to criticize Russia while you're there, because they'll take your visa away and send you home. Why did you go to Russia? It's a very simple thing. You do not have a right to a visa to be in the United States. You don't. So that is, I don't even actually consider it deportation. I consider it revoking the privilege of being here, and now you got to get on a plane and go home. I'm telling you, I know technically, legally it's deportation, but I see deportation, the person got in the country, they weren't supposed to be here, we arrest them, and we forcibly return them to their country. What's been done to these people is they've had their visas removed. Did they commit a crime? Don't know. Don't care. And I'll tell you that I think the things that they're doing, yes, an American citizen going to the same college can do that thing and not go to jail and not be thrown out of the country and not face any serious consequences other than if the university wants to enact them. Fine. Still don't care. You don't, like, your right to free speech doesn't mean you, it also includes your right to be here if you're not a citizen. Sorry. We should be borderless, but we're not. Can I go to any other country and do this shit? No. We're supposed to be different, but we're not. And we never said we were that way. So I don't give a shit. And I know some of you really have a hard time with that. Don't care. Not my problem. Now, the American citizens being sent to a prison in another country, that's basically exile plus imprisonment, that I'm not okay with in any way. I don't know why Trump doesn't say some of the shit he says, other than to off balance or fear, you know, maybe if you can make the person afraid that this could happen, then they're less likely to, I don't know. This is up there with the Canada 51st state. Like, you know, everybody stopped talking about that. You know why? Because it's not going to happen. It never was going to happen. There was some weird reason he did it. He still hasn't explained himself. I don't know if he ever will. But they're different things. They're different things to me. And no, I would say that, like, the day that the Trump administration attempted to extradite a United States citizen in reverse to face prison time in a foreign nation when the crime they committed was in this nation, and that other country hasn't specifically requested extradition, no. That is grounds for impeachment. And not only do I think it would be a very quick impeachment, I think that if it was actually done or attempted to do, there is a shitload of Republicans in the government, like the Congress, that would side with impeaching and removing Trump from office and potentially finding a way for criminal charges. And I would support it. So if you think I'm just blindly supporting everything Orange Man does, because you ain't been around here very long, when I say that you could throw a student on a student visa out of the country, I'm not. I mean, I would be for putting his... And I was not for him being prosecuted the way he was at all. I stood up against that the whole time it went on over all these years. Not a lot, because that's not really what we do here, but I thought it was atrocious. I thought it was malicious prosecution. I thought it was lawfare. But if he did that, no, that is a clear violation of the United States Constitution. And the two things are not the same, and I don't know that they really intended to present them as, but it kind of came off that way a bit to me. No, you have no right to be in somebody else's country on a visa if you do not do what they stipulate needs to be done to maintain that visa. And you don't even, I'll put it in a different way. I wouldn't give a shit if the United States of America decided, you know what, we don't want to do student visas anymore. Out. Everybody. Go home. I don't have a problem with that either. Why? What the fuck are we doing? Giving college seats at prestigious universities to foreign nationals, while Americans with good test scores, mostly white males, by the way, can't get into these colleges. Do we have no business doing this in the first place? What do we gain by this? Cultural diversity or some shit? This whole program to me, here's part of why I have no sympathy. I would nix this program tomorrow if I was like overloaded the country. Like, at least, like, can I just do what I want to do as an anarchist? No, you have to stay in the framework. Okay, fine. Then we're cutting that shit off. We gain nothing from this. We gain nothing from this except taking a seat that could go to an American and giving it to someone from another country so they can take an education from our country and go back to their own with it, for good or ill. I'm not okay with it. I'm sorry. Let's move on. Let's hear about what to do with surplus capital from Matt and John.
Hey, TSP, we got a question from Hunter about what to do with surplus income. I think a lot of his question pertains to taxes, so I'll defer those answers to Matt, the agorist tax guy. And I'm going to give a relatively simple and quick answer here because, Hunter, I'm going to refer you to a podcast that I did a couple years ago that really addresses a lot of these issues in detail. But just to give you a quick summary, you know, what do you do with surplus income? If you've ever listened to what I've said in my podcast, I talk about a simple process to building wealth: earn, save, invest. There's a lot of different ways you can handle each of those categories, but the bottom line is, if you want to build wealth long term, you have to master all three. You've been running your business for 5 years now, so congratulations, you've really made it over that hurdle that, you know, 90% or more of entrepreneurs never make it past. So you've got that earnings part down. And since you are self-employed, I'm going to emphasize what I always tell entrepreneurs, and that's invest in yourself first. You know, you're going to make a much better return on money invested in your own business than money invested in anything else, right? Because you have total control over that. And if you're good at what you do, you can get exponential growth and returns on that investment. You know, you're not going to get that from investing in the stock market or generally in real estate or anything else. So to the extent that you can continue to build and grow your business, or hey, you've been doing what you're doing now for 5 years, you could do something else if you wanted to, right? You've obviously broken the code of being a small business owner. So if you think there's additional revenue streams within your business or another business that you could create, I'd encourage you to invest in that and continue to build your own personal business. But aside from that, beyond that, what do? Well, I think the problem that most people make with savings is they get over-focused on one thing. You know, they just want to max out a retirement plan, or they just want to pay down their mortgage, or they're focused on some other goal. And really what I advise people to do is take a holistic approach and do what I call parallel savings, where you're simultaneously saving a little bit of money in a lot of categories. The reason for this is both psychological as well as practical. From the practical standpoint, money is fungible. And so even though you're spreading your money out thin over multiple areas, it's generally still accessible to you should you need it for something else. Where I think the psychological part kicks in is that life isn't all about just one thing. Achieving success, it's a multitude of little decisions and little goals and achievements that you make day in, day out, year in, year out. So to the extent that you have excess money that you're no longer putting in your business, start thinking about those areas that you want to start saving in. A podcast I did back in January of 2023 was entitled Parallel Savings in Buckets and Wells. It's episode number 400. And what I stress in there is think about saving money in different buckets, right? You may have a bucket to pay down your mortgage. You may have a bucket for a retirement plan. You may have a bucket to buy your next vehicle or for your next vacation. And I think it's best to put a little bit of money in all these buckets. And if you do that consistently and you're investing it properly, over the years and decades, not only will you have buckets full of money, but those buckets will have turned into wells. And instead of just containing your wealth, they'll be growing your wealth. And the ultimate realization of being financially independent is that your investments are earning and working harder than you are. That's the principle of the richest man in Babylon, where he talks about having your money be a slave for you. And then in specific terms, you know, I don't know your personal situation, but maybe you just want to put your retirement savings in a personal Roth IRA, or perhaps it's more advantageous to start a solo or an individual Roth 401k. Again, that's going to be unique to you and how much money you're making and what your overall goals are. But I'd focus more on developing those disciplined saver behavioral patterns, at least initially, before I worried so much about the overall investment decisions associated with them. Well, hey, again, check out episode 400 of the Wealthsteading podcast for more information.
Hey, TSP crew. This is Matthew Sersley of AgoristTaxAdvice.com. Got a listener question about what to do with some extra income. Question, what do I do with surplus income? I'm not going to read the whole question, but I'm coming into a lot of income after 5 years of building my home inspection business. I'm paying off debt. I've paid off the purchase of the business, and now things are picking up. I've given myself a small raise, and I'm saving more, but I want to be smart with the extra. Couple questions. Should I increase my W-2 salary? Is it better to invest surplus funds from business or transfer to the personal account first? And besides building reserves, are there other strategic or tax-smart ways I should be reinvesting in the business? And then finally, a comment. I don't need new equipment right now, so I'm going to avoid spending it just to lower taxes. So just want to remind everybody, I am a tax advisor. I'm not a financial advisor. There are rules on what I can and cannot say. I'm not going to make any specific suggestions for you, but I'm going to talk a little bit about what I might do and some of the tax consequences. I want to start at the end first. I'm really glad that you're not going to be spending money on equipment just to lower your taxes. That tends to be a really foolish piece of advice that a lot of people have heard. You know, oh, just go out and buy stuff. Go buy a car. You'll save money on your taxes. And that's true if your only goal is to pay less in taxes, but it's not true if your goal is to keep as much money as possible. You know, spending $70,000 on a new car for a $30,000 tax write-off is pretty foolish if you don't need a new car. If you need the new car, it can be great. But it's just a terrible, terrible idea to spend money just to lower your taxes. Spend money on what you need. Should I increase my W-2 salary? Well, that really depends. In general, you probably should be increasing your salary every single year with an S-Corp, assuming you're spending the same amount of time on it. If you've gotten to the point where you've got employees and you've got contractors and you are spending less time on the business, you could actually lower your salary as you have more people do other work. Is it better to invest surplus funds from the business or transfer to my personal account first? Almost always better to transfer to your personal account first. The only reason to leave money in the business account is if you're maybe thinking about trying to get some sort of a loan, and so you want collateral to be in the business. And even then, it's probably not going to matter, because if it's things like cash or stock, that's not going to be very much collateral that they're going to consider, because you could just transfer it out. Similarly, if you get into a situation where you get sued for something in your business, your corporation or LLC will help protect your assets, but it won't protect your business assets. So I'm a big believer in pulling out most of the money from my company, either through salary or capital distributions. Leave enough for anywhere from 3 to 6 months of business expenses, but pull the rest out. Are there any other strategic or tax smart ways I should be reinvesting in the business? Well, one of the best ways is to reinvest in yourself. If there are things you can do to make yourself better at your job, or just make yourself a better person and a healthier person, that can be a great way to be tax smart, if you can use it as a business expense to improve yourself in some way. But I'm a big believer that when it comes to investing, your goal should be maximizing your after-tax return, not to minimize taxes. Because it's really easy to minimize your taxes just by nothing but municipal bonds, which are typically tax-free, but they also pay basically nothing. So I focus much more on investing in what is a good investment, and then I worry about the tax consequences. The one thing you probably should be doing if you're in this situation, you should at the very minimum be maximizing your Roth IRA contribution. If you're really wanting to put away a lot of money for investing, you could do it into a solo 401k if you don't have any employees. There you can put away $60,000 a year or more. And recently that whole contribution can be a Roth contribution, and that can be per year. You also can take that solo 401k and make it a self-directed IRA, so you can use that to invest in things other than stocks and crypto and bonds. You can invest in real estate. You can invest in, you know, almost anything with a self-directed IRA if you're willing to follow the rules and do all the paperwork. So not going to tell you what to invest there necessarily, but doing it in some sort of a Roth account where all the growth will be tax-free, and then you can take it out tax-free after you're 59 and a half. That is a great way to put money away for investing. Wouldn't be me if I didn't bring up the possibility of investing in real estate as well. That I actually typically like to do not in a Roth IRA. I'll do it in a Roth IRA, but there's so many tax advantages to having it that you kind of lose in a Roth IRA. I'd rather invest in my own personal name, use the Roth for something else. But one of the best real estate investments, or one of the best tax investments, can be investing in real estate. You know, not every area of the country is a good place to invest right now, but there are good places to invest right now. I'm personally right now looking in Memphis. I'm looking in Cleveland. I'm looking at some places in Florida for my own investments. And one of the great things about investing in real estate is most or all of your gains are going to be tax-free as long as you do it right. And if you do it right and you have somebody else, or if you yourself can qualify as a real estate professional as well, that can be an even bigger advantage. And I'm guessing, since you're in a home inspection business, you in particular might know a little bit more about real estate. Maybe you have some local connections. You don't have to buy where you are. I don't own any real estate other than my house within, I mean, like 500 miles of myself. But it is always nice when you can invest in the area, especially if you're going to be managing it yourself or doing something like that. Well, I hope this was helpful. If you've got questions, please send them in to Jack. If you want to talk to me personally, please go to agoristpaxadvice.com/TSP. You'll get a free download with a bunch of tax tips on possible business deductions, and then you'll get an invite to schedule a free phone call with me in a few days. Have fun. Talk to you later.
So a couple things on that that I'll add. One is I completely agree with Matthew that one place to look is real estate. And the reason to look with real estate is you can use a little bit of money to own a lot of property. That's a form of leverage. In other words, you're not going to go out. Let's say you had $200,000 worth of surplus capital. I don't know if you have that much, but let's say that you did. You're not going to go out and look for a house under $200,000. Buy the whole house for $200,000. And then turn around and rent it and slowly get your money back over time while you already have equity. That is a financially stupid way to do real estate in the current economic system and tax system that we have. It's also the Dave Ramsey way, and it's one of the many reasons I say Dave Ramsey's advice on debt is gold, and his advice on investing is absolute hot dog shit. I mean, it's steaming hot dog shit. Just don't listen to him about investing. And then you can learn everything you need to know about the debt problem in about 10 minutes from the day. I could do Dave Ramsey's show and answer every question. Has the same freaking answer restated differently every time. So real estate is great because I could take, let's say, $200,000. I could take maybe $100,000, set it aside, and go in with five different properties with $20,000 strong down payments, and maybe control as much as a couple million dollars worth of real estate with that. I could then have other people pay the equity for me, and I'm only in it at that point if I went that far. If I found five great properties in that zone, right, I am leveraging $50,000 to $2 million, and it's in a very low risk because I'm never going to go to the negative in it. I've got real property underlying it. As long as I don't buy like a moron, I can always exit and come out a little bit ahead in the worst case scenario. I just talked about the guy I talked about yesterday, though, that's cutting trees. I just talked to him about this. He's upset that his landlord raised his rent after 1 year, $100. And he said, is that reasonable? I said, well, the first thing to do is go out and look and see what the kind of house you're in is renting for right now in the market. Because if he's charging you market rate or lower, you're getting a deal. Because it's a competitive market right now. And I'm like, you know, his property taxes may have went up. And then if his assessment went up, his insurance. Like, there is another side to being a landlord. But the good thing about being a landlord in this state is it's actually really easy to get somebody who's not paying you the hell out. There are states where it can take you a year or even, as sane as it sounds, up to 2 years to get rid of somebody that's not paying you. And it's just very untested. So you got to know that market before you go into it. The word that neither of them said, and I know at least one of them full-on invests in it, and the other one, as reluctant as he is, I know he made a bunch of money on Grayscale, and that is Bitcoin. Bitcoin is where surplus capital should be going right now, in my opinion, at least some portion thereof. And I'm not saying if let's go back to $200,000, just buy $200,000. I would say break a piece off, whatever you're comfortable with. Figure out how long you want to invest that money, how long you want to take to get that money into that investment. And then divide that number by the number of days of that time frame and daily DCA into it. I am completely in agreement with Matthew. Get the money. If it's surplus and you're really not going to use it in the business, you can always put it back into your business, right? You can always put it into your business, basically buying in or investing in your own business, okay? But if it's in there at the time you're served, like he said, and he's a lawyer, so he knows, then it gets, like, basically, it's a business asset, and if I'm suing the business, your corporate veil may protect you personally, and that's even weaker than it was just 20 years ago. But there's some protection. But if the money's in the business, there is zero protection, especially if you go into a bankruptcy. So get the surplus capital out. And then the other thing is, like I said, Bitcoin. So how much? Well, I don't know. My rule for anything like a Bitcoin, a volatile investment, is if it is 5 year or more surplus capital, it is a great place for it to go. If you might need the money in 6 months to a year, do not put it into a volatile investment. Because what will inevitably happen is you will end up not just needing it, but you'll end up needing it at a particularly low point in the market where you then have to liquidate something at a loss. And yeah, you can write off your taxes, but that's not the goal. So when I say surplus, when I say surplus capital, see, I don't know what you mean. When I say surplus capital, I'm like money I don't need now and I clearly won't need for at least 5 years. That's what I mean. And when I have that money, the first place I look is Bitcoin. Now, investing it back into your business, and you know, you say, I don't need new equipment, whatever. The big thing with that, and John said, and I agree to a point, the best place to invest your money is in your own business because you have full control over it. But maybe it is the case that your business doesn't need that money right now. You can piss away a lot of money on advertising, but if the advertising's not going to actually grow your business more than the cost of advertising, don't do it. My CPA, as great as she is, and she's amazing, every freaking year, well, maybe you should advertise more. Why? So I can piss my money away and you feel better because my bottom line taxes? Like, I told her last time, I'm like, look, if I had my way, because she works for a firm, you would get every penny I pay your firm. And I would tip you 20% if I could. Like, you're that good. I already feel like I pay incredibly low taxes because of what you do. But your advice on how to run my business is terrible because you don't know how to run a business. Because if you did, you wouldn't work for a firm. You'd have your own firm, which you could. But you don't, because you don't want to run a business, so therefore, all you know is the tax consequences of the decision. You don't know the consequences of the decision on the business. And she's like, well, I guess you're right. I'm like, okay. So stop telling me to advertise more every year, because I don't want to, because I know that the ROI on that advertising will never beat the ROI on the advertising I get just by having people talk about it. I'd rather invest that money like in my book that's about to come out. That book will be the best advertising I've ever done for this show. That's the way that I look at it, right? So invest in yourself, yes, but be smart about how you invest in yourself when it comes to things like investing in your business. Your business, if it doesn't have a clear path, like here's the way I look at it. Let's say, well, this actually happened to me. When TSP really took off, after I quit working with Neil, and we kind of separated as business partners, about a year after that, he looked at what I was doing. He's like, this is really going well, Nate. You know, and he's like, right, why don't we come in? I'll buy 10% of the business. And I'm not going to say the number he offered, but it was totally out of whack as a valuation, right? Like, giving him 10% for what he was offering me, I'd still be ahead today if I had done nothing with the money. Like, if I just took the money and put it in the bank in a CD at 1%, I'd be way ahead, even giving him 10% back over those years. Because it was a ridiculous amount of money. That's part of why I said no, because I don't want to take money from a friend as a partner that's wrong. The other thing is, then I have a 10% partner going, I think you need to do this. I think, no, I don't want to friggin' do that. But the bigger reason was, I looked at the money and said, I don't know what I would do with it other than put it away or invest it in something outside the business, which is not why a partner. And I basically told him no, and I had to be very forceful because he's a guy that doesn't take no easily. There was no place for that money to actually grow my business other than advertising with no guarantee or like hiring a staff. And then when the money that hires the staff runs out, I still have the staff. And if they haven't built the business to a point where they can pay for themselves, they all have to go and I'm out nothing and I'm stuck with a 10% partner. So even though you wouldn't be stuck with a partner, you have to look at your money the same way. If you don't know what you would do with it in your business, get it out of your business. You can always put it back in. If you think your business could come on hard times and you might need some money, set some portion aside, make it very, very liquid and non-volatile, and then do something aggressive with the balance. That's especially at your age. That's my advice. And the legal advice from Matt is dead on. Next up, Andy McCann will talk about strengthening your back, which is a really important thing, especially as we age.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann, your health and fitness guy, coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. So I'm going to answer a question for Andy. Andy, I love the name. Andy says, hey, Jack, Andy, question. How do I strengthen my back spine? Now, I'm going to go with not actually strengthening your spine, because really the way to strengthen your spine, I suppose, would be to get miniature cracks and let it heal, and that would make your spine strong. But I know what you're saying here. How do I strengthen the muscles around that and give myself a better core for what I'm doing outside? Okay, so background. 35 years old, just pulled my back and pinched my sciatic nerve, got it corrected by my chiropractor. Looking for ways to keep my back strong as I grow older. Some more background, he's very active outside, has a homestead, does a lot of tree work, lumber mill, sawmill, all that, but he has a desk job. Okay, so Andy, here's what I would say. You are correct in saying I want to strengthen, but also I want to understand what I can do to keep it from happening again. So strength will do it, But another one's probably going to be because you're moving around so much, you also want to mobilize. So I've got a couple things for you. One, for a very specific my back hurts, this is what I do. So I chased, stupidly, I chased a 400-pound deadlift with my buddies in CrossFit back in like 2009. They're like, let's lift. I'm like, sure, why not? And I'm not a big dude. I should not have done that. I did hit it, so check box for me. But I did something weird to my back that it's never been the same. So I do this rolling maintenance thing every day. So every time I actually don't even have to work out. I just do this. I have a PVC pipe at home, and I do this rolling. So I'll post, or I'll give a link to Jack, and he can post it. But if you go to my YouTube page, AndyMcCann42, and then type in rolling, you'll see my maintenance mode rolling after class. And I do this every time. So what I would suggest you, and I'll link this to Jack as well, is you get this foam roller right here. So this guy right here is cheap. I think it's like 10 bucks, and there's like a 111,000 reviews on it. It's just a decent foam roller, and I would start there. The next thing I would do is upgrade to a PVC pipe from Home Depot. It's basically the exact same thing, 13, 14 bucks, but it's going to be harder, and it's going to press more into your body. Okay, so what I would do, the first thing I would do is to roll that puppy out. Anyway, that's going to take care of your lower back. I would roll your sides of your spine, not your spine, the sides of it, like lean left, lean right. Roll your left and right glutes, and then flip over and roll your IT band. So you can watch the video and see that. I would definitely start doing that. It's going to help a lot, especially if you get to a harder pipe like PVC. Now, on the strengthening side, one more on the flexibility. You can follow this one. It used to be called ROMWOD. Now it's called Pliability, but they go through a whole lot of flexibility things. It's kind of like doing yoga, sort of. Anyway, of course I love CrossFit, and if you look at their title, like what is CrossFit? It's a core to extremity muscular recruitment program. So the whole idea is to get you stronger. But there are faster ways to do just specifically that, especially if you're light on time and you have one goal of getting my back stronger. All right, I'm going to go through this kind of quick. I'm going to turn your question into an entire episode for myself. So it'll probably be episode number 197 and should come out, let's see, what would that be, on maybe February 24th. So if you want to find that, you'll get a lot more details there. But basically, if you want to strengthen your back, then you want to load your core and be able to squeeze. Now, I would never go towards weight belts because you're going to do more than your back could lift, and it's not really doing what you want. You want to strengthen your back. So back squat and deadlift would probably be the primary thing that I would do. I'd also look up how to do a proper squat. Go to a full depth. Don't do like half squats. You can do CrossFit squat or full range of motion squat, and you'll see that. Or I've got videos walking people through that as well. But basically get a full squat in there, and don't go so heavy that you're certainly straining. I would definitely keep this in the realm of like 5 sets of 8, 3 sets of 8, 3 sets of 10. Basically, 10 or 8 reps so that the weight isn't so heavy that it's going to cause a problem. But you can vary that as well with increasing the time under tension. So you could do a tempo lift where you do like 5 seconds down and then you explode up or something like that. The whole idea is you want to force your core to engage. And there's a couple ways to engage your core. You can just like squeeze, or you can take your fingertips, put them under your rib cage, and then squeeze down. If your fingers pop out, you've squeezed correctly. There's another way to do it where you squeeze from down below, and then you squeeze it like kind of on the inside. You have to sort of imagine it happening. It's not easy to find at first. It's kind of like akin to doing a Kegel. Dr. Kegel came up with that for men and women with either after babies or having issue holding your going to the bathroom or whatever. So you do a Kegel, squeeze up on the inside, and then squeeze back down around the outside. Okay, so also realize that all of these things are tied together. So if your lower back is weak, then your upper back and your glutes are probably weak too. So you want to strengthen around those two. This is why a back squat would be awesome. Or a deadlift is going to limit the motion a bit, but it's going to increase that stability as well. Most likely, it's going to be mobility and flexibility, especially if you're doing a lot of swinging and turning with the lumbar work. You're going to want to roll this guy out. And I'll give you some exercises you can do that are kind of akin to Pilates or yoga. I'm going to go through these kind of fast, and you can Google them or YouTube them to see what they are. But here you go. Bird dog, side planks, glute bridges, Superman hold, dead hang, Romanian deadlift, farmer's carry. I also like suitcase carry, and the Jefferson curls. Three more are the cat-cow stretch, hip flexor stretch, and the hamstring stretch. All right, so because you're already in the place of pain like me, you're going to really need to pay attention to this daily. So I would do things that's going to be a combination of strength, not every day, flexibility and mobility every day, and just be conscious of when this is happening. There could be times like swinging an axe or something like that that's occurring. It is a normal thing that when you do strength with pivot, you're going to have some issues. So just be careful there. Again, I'm going to turn this into a full episode. You can see it there. Also, I got stuff for you guys. If you go to crossfitgarage.com/TSPC, you're going to see all the free stuff that I've been putting out for you guys. You can click on any of the links right there. If you happen to be in the Woodstock, Georgia area, come to the gym. If you're in Cherokee County, we're going to do a chicken meetup. So we do some homesteading, of course, because, hey, man, this is a survival podcast. All right, guys, y'all take care.
All right, so I have two links under Andy's segment there. One on the foam roller that he recommends. And if you're going to try this, I've actually tried this because he's talked about this before. I really recommend you do what he said. Go pick up the $10, $12 foam roller from Amazon. Start with that. If you start with the PVC pipe, it's going to hurt so much that you're not going to want to keep doing it until you develop the technique and kind of the conditioning. And so you'll quit and you'll deny yourself the opportunity because it hurts more than you think when you do it with that, especially when you've never done it before, because as you do it, you will figure out, like, oh, that really, I need to do this. Like, there's a lot of little micro muscle control that goes into the exercise he's talking about that I don't even know that you know it's there, but it's there. There is a certain amount of muscle memory, micro, tiny little movements and things like that in anything we do. That's why, you know, one person that plays darts is a handicap of a 28 and the other one's a 20 and they're both good and they both look like they're, but it's the little tiny micro things that make the difference. Next, I also have, again, that video of him showing you how to do it in the notes, but I forgot to mention with John and Matt in the last one. John mentioned that he had a podcast, episode 400 of the Well Studying Podcast. And John, you might want to start like numbering your episodes in the title, but using the search function and the number 400, I was able to find it. I have a link to that as well. Now, let's talk about something from, we just had a home inspector in the prior segment with Surplus Capital. We have a home inspector right now going to answer a question about a crack in the foundation. And this is not as easy to answer as you might think. Let's hear from Ryan Steva.
Hey, TSP community. This is Ryan Steva with thehomesteadconsultant.com and clarityhomeinspection.com. Today, I've got a question from Andy from Tennessee, and he asks about how to determine if a foundation crack is a serious issue or a structural issue. And though I can't actually give you that information in an audio format or really in a video format, it's something that you learn over time in training and experience. I can give some pointers and some overall viewpoints on what to look for and what may or may not be important. So I'm going to cover some of those things. I'm going to start with things that you really probably shouldn't be concerned about. So if you see a hairline crack or shrinkage cracks in your concrete or block wall, those are not going to be very concerning. The hairline crack, if you see that it's getting bigger over time, that is something concerning that you want to address. But if it's just a small crack and it's just staying the same size, I would not be worried about it. Shrinkage cracks are basically non-important. Basically what's happening is you get a differential between the curing time of certain portions or certain layers of the concrete. And it really speaks more to the quality of the people making, mixing, and pouring the concrete than it does the settlement of the foundation. Basically, what a shrinkage crack is going to look like is a tear in the cement, generally on the top layer. And it's below that, it's not going to continue, or it's not going to be significant below that. So those are pretty common. The next type of cracking that you want to look for is actually going to be your two most potentially problematic cracks, which is horizontal cracking and displacement cracking. So with horizontal cracks, that's going to be on the horizontal plane, generally below grade, and those are oftentimes caused by hydraulic pressure on the outside of the wall from wet soil or expansive wet soil. And those can be really problematic in that the bigger they get, the faster they'll move because the weaker the wall is. And so there's this compounding effect as they get larger. So if you see a horizontal crack, there's a good chance that that's problematic. And the bigger it is, the more problematic it is. And then as far as displacement cracks, what those are is similar to the horizontal crack where you've got, generally speaking, hydraulic pressure from the outside where you've got wet soils or expansive wet soils. And one section is pushed in while another portion of the wall stays in the same place. So you get this displacement of the wall. That can also be a fairly strong indication of potential structural issues. Stair-step cracks are a pretty big mixed bag here because some of them can be essentially non-problematic, while others could actually indicate a bigger problem. Oftentimes the ones that are indicating a bigger problem will get larger at one end as opposed to the other. So stair steps basically follow the mortar of a block wall or a brick wall. And if you see that the crack gets wider at the top than it is at the bottom or vice versa, that is generally speaking an indication of uneven settlement somewhere. And so that can be a concerning issue, especially if it becomes too wide. So if you're anywhere nearing a quarter of an inch, that's going to start, generally speaking, to be concerning. And less than an eighth of an inch is, generally speaking, not going to be especially concerning, but I would keep an eye on it, see if it's moving at all. Last is cracking in slabs. Now, there's different types of slabs, so I'm not talking about post-tension slabs. If you have a post-tension slab, they're a very much different animal, but just a general poured slab on grade. If you see a few small cracks, very small cracks, or hairline cracks, I would not be concerned about those. However, if you see a crack that looks like the entire section of slab is moving away from another, so you've got a crack that's even across a distance, and it looks like it goes down quite a ways, that could be a concerning issue and should probably be checked out by a professional. A couple of additional things that may indicate structural movement that you should look for that could be clues on top of what we already talked about are water intrusion or efflorescence. Basically, white mineral deposits or dark staining from water are indications of water being in the soil and pushing through into the home. Keep in mind that cracking bricks on the exterior of homes are that the brick is a facade, and so it may or may not reflect settlement of the foundation. It may just be settlement of the brick itself, which isn't necessarily directly connected to the foundation in all cases. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag as far as whether or not that will give you any type of indication. And then interior signs, if you have doors that start sticking on the frames or jams, or if you have floors that slope, or if you have cracks above windows and doors, especially if it's continuing to expand or change, those are all indications of potential settlement, especially when you put all of them together. So basically, the cause of settlement of a home is almost always going to be, and primarily is, water. That can either be from heaving from expansive soils or from settlement of saturated soils. Both are obviously problematic, and I would say probably in the 95 to 98% range that just too much moisture around the home is the root cause for settlement or movement of the home. Some ways that you can monitor the cracking in the home is to measure and photograph the cracks regularly, so maybe once every couple of months. Use a mortar or grout bag, which looks like a pastry bag for piping onto pastry, but it's called a grout bag, and you can basically use that to pipe grout into the crack, and if the crack reappears, then you know the settlement is ongoing, and then just track the progress or movement over time. Recommendations as far as professionals are concerned, I would highly recommend avoiding any of the foundation repair companies you hear on the radio or TV. Basically, they're sales companies, not foundation companies, and the work that they do is generally subpar and very expensive. So I would, generally speaking, talk with somebody like a structural engineer or a similar contractor who is not going to do the actual work that they're evaluating, so they don't have a perverse incentive to find issues that aren't actually issues. I would also say that home inspectors can look at that in some cases, but just keep in mind that we're not specialists in foundations, we're generalists. So we're generalists about homes in general, and over time we get experience with what a crack may mean or a better understanding of how that works. But a structural engineer is going to be a specialist in this area. And finally, as I was saying, water is almost always the issue, so grading and proper drainage are going to be your primary means of alleviating these issues. So fixed negative grade or negative slope, and improve gutters and downspouts and runoff systems. And if you want a detailed look into this, if you look up episode 3611, I go over how to deal with grade and grading issues. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you want to get a hold of me, just look me up on thehomesteadconsultant.com or clarityhomeinspection.com and get some more questions out to Jack. I could really use some to answer. Thanks, everyone.
Great stuff from Ryan. I just want to throw a thank you out, because I don't say it enough, to everybody on the expert council, past and present as well, man, because we've had some great people come and go over the years, because this is a true service thing to the community. Yeah, some of them have some businesses, and it may give them some exposure and all, but it really is a service. They're giving far more than they'll ever get back. And sometimes people build their things so large, they're like, I really don't have time to do this anymore. I've been recently talking a lot to Charles Sandville, the humble mechanic, and that was exactly what happened. He was a expert council member for about 2 years and then said, dude, I really can't do a good job for you because I got these other things to do. I understand that. But all of these people over the years have done a great service to this community. And I want you to know we have recently updated the About the Expert Council, Meet the Expert Council page. And if you go to the site, you go to the About tab, and then it'll be a pop-down menu. And toward the bottom of that pop-down menu will be Meet Your Expert Council. If you click that, you'll see everybody, and that will help you figure out what questions that you need to ask. A couple people have been removed, a bunch of people have been added, and there's a couple people who have been added that aren't on the page yet because they haven't got their shit in yet, but we're trying to get that page updated. And I need to make sure I do a good job of always linking to that page from the Expert Council shows. If you want to ask a question of an Expert Council member, it's really easy to do, and you're also getting an answer if you do what I'm about to say are really, really high. You send an email to me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. In the subject line, you put TSPC space expert. Then you ask your question, and you say, my question is for expert council member blah, whoever blah is, and it is. And then in one sentence, with a question mark at the end, you ask your question. But I have other things. Great. Hit return a couple times. Put a space in there. Give me your details. Everybody knows what you're asking. And all the details are there. And trust me, if you don't give enough detail, if there's something missing, that expert council member will probably hit reply all and ask you the question, because your email will go to them. They'll know your email address. So if they need more, they'll ask for it. So just be really concrete, crystal clear on what you're asking, and then detail away. And I could use some more questions. I have enough content right now that I will be doing this week, the expert council show for next week while I'm gone at Nicole's for Living Free in Tennessee. But the following week, I'm going to be pretty wrung out for, and next week's going to be hectic, and I'm not probably going to do a good job of reminding them. So if I can get questions this week and weekend, and I can get those out, I can prime the pump for the following week after I get back, because getting back week is always hectic. Anyway, with that, let's talk more now with some expert council members. This is from Chef Ken Daniels. Guys, I need some questions for him. I know you guys like to cook. I know you guys got all kinds of stuff you want to try. Send them in for Chef Ken. Well, Chef Ken has an answer for us right now on using a mushroom called maitake, and I love these things. And I have a little add-on to this one of the perfect thing to drizzle over them after you make them the way he tells you, and it's stupid simple to do.
Hello all. Today's question comes from Rachel. She sent a picture of maitake mushrooms from a farmer's market and asked for some info on how to handle these. Rachel, you've stumbled on one of my best kept secrets, maitake or hen of the woods mushrooms. Now, these aren't the usual mushrooms you probably grew up with. Not the sad little button mushrooms that show up sliced in a plastic tub. And not the big portobellos you throw on a grill when someone says that they're a vegetarian and they're coming to the barbecue. Nah, today we're talking about mushrooms that I absolutely love. And let me tell you something right up front. Maitake mushrooms are super special. They're not just this other mushroom. They're not this weird grocery store novelty. These are things that are flat out better, better flavor, better texture, and a better experience. And I get it. These mushrooms are a little intimidating to look at. They're wild and frilly and almost floral. They look like they belong growing on the side of some mossy tree in a forest from Lord of the Rings. They're not your typical stem and cap image we've grown up with. So most people walk right past them at stores because they don't know what they're getting into. And because maitake does something most mushrooms don't do, it gives you this most incredible contrast in texture when you cook it properly. Crispy, delicate, frilly edges, and at the same time, tender and juicy stems. It's like getting the crunch of a great potato chip and the juiciness of a perfect steak all in one bite. And that, my friends, is mushroom magic. Now, here's where most people go wrong. They treat maitake like button mushrooms or portobellos. They toss them in a pan with a little oil, medium heat, maybe salt them right away. And what happens? They steam. They get soggy. They turn floppy. All that beautiful, frilly texture, gone. And let me be clear. Maitake mushrooms want hot and fast cooking. Aggression. They want space to breathe in the pan or in the tray. Steam is the enemy here. If there's moisture hanging around, your mushrooms are never going to crisp. And maitakes love to crisp up. Rule number one. Do not salt them early if you're cooking them in a pan. Salt draws out moisture. And if you've got moisture hanging around, you're steaming, not roasting. Okay, so you've got options here now. Get your pan, oven, even air fryer ripping hot. I mean, crank it to like 425. These mushrooms can handle it. Air fryer, absolutely. If I even crack the drawer slightly for the first 5 minutes to let the steam escape. Oven, crank that sucker up. Spread it out evenly over sheet tray. And yes, again, I crack the door just so I can let some of that steam roll out. Grill, perfect for bigger clusters. Direct heat, high flame, it loves it. Spread them out, give them breathing room, tear them into big natural pieces. Never, ever slice them. Hand tearing is where you're going to get that more natural, frilly edges that those pieces want to crisp up. And when it comes to cooking, olive oil is fine. I'm not going to fight you on olive oil. But if you really want to make these maitakes sing, animal fat is where it's at. Butter is great. Tallow is amazing. But duck fat is my personal go-to for this mushroom. Even rendered chicken fat works beautifully here. Olive oil can sometimes lend this like grassy sautéed flavor that kind of muddies the deep earthy maitake flavor. Now, here's a trick most folks never learn. Once you've driven off that moisture and the frilly edges are golden and lacy, take them off the heat and don't dare pile them up in a bowl or let them stew in their own juices. Lay them on a single layer of paper towel, let them rest, and let that last little bit of steam escape. Let them firm up. Give them about 5 minutes. Now you salt. Now you season. A little salt, a little pepper, just keep it simple. So here's the pro tip. After they rest and season, back in the pan or oven for just another minute or two. That little refire locks everything into place. Most of the moisture has been released, and this second fire is where the magic happens and the crisping of those edges. Okay, so let's talk sauces. My personal favorite way to sauce maitake is pretty simple, but it's more of a technique. I just dip the stem sides of the cooked mushrooms into whatever sauce I'm using. Could be miso butter, could be ponzu, could be some spicy chili crisp oil, but I leave those crispy edges untouched and dry. The texture is just too good to drown in sauce. This way you get that meaty, juicy stem with a little hint of sauce, but I still have all those crispy edges. So that's it. That's my world of maitake mushrooms. You could put them in soups for an extra umami punch. You could even dice them up and use them as traditional boring mushrooms. But I think you're missing the magic of these maitakes if you do that. They're bold, they're forgiving, and they're absolutely one of the most satisfying things you can cook, especially if you love food with texture. And honestly, once you cook these maitakes right, it's real hard to go back to those old plain button mushrooms without just feeling a little sad inside. Look, hot and fast, no crowding, let it rest, season, and refire. Tear it big and treat those frilly edges like they're gold, man. That's the move. Rachel, I hope this helps. FYI, I just released my own recipes based on the American Diabetes 7-Day Meal Plan at BloodSugarChef.com. Each day has breakfast, lunch, and dinner recipes for 7 days. There are 7 different meal plans, ranging from meat lovers, Mediterranean, vegetarian, budget-friendly. So that's 147 recipes for free, all designed designed by me. These have tips and tricks included. Look, I'm not associated with the American Diabetes Society, but I took their meal plans and expanded on them. So go check them out. Remember, if you guys have any other questions, please contact me at ken@bloodsugarchef.com. Keep those questions rolling in. Until next time, this has been Chef Ken. Cheers.
Okay, a couple things on that. One of the things I wanted to tell you is the name, Maitake. It sounds Asian, right? It's actually Japanese. And what it actually means is dance mushroom. And the reason that it means dance mushroom is they're such a wonderful mushroom that people would dance with joy when they found them. And they'd really dance with joy because you find one, there's probably more around. And they tend to grow on the base of oak trees. But this is a North American native mushroom, right? Well, various versions of the maitake are native from Europe into Asia and Japan and the United States. And into Canada as well. You need a cool, temperate region, so sadly I can't find them anymore where I live. The other thing I want to add is the way Ken just told you to cook them, one of my favorite restaurants on planet Earth is a place in Fort Worth, and I think they have one in Colorado and one in Austin too, called Lonesome Dove. And this is a restaurant from Chef Tim Love, and I love Tim Love overall. Like one of the things I did at a lot of workshops as I serve these elk sausages and these rattle and rabbit steak sausages, rattlesnake and rabbit sausages, both made by Chef Tim Love's Love Bodega catering. So long history with him. And the only reason I only go to Lonesome Dove like maybe once a year is like it's a place that like if let's say a couple's in town that Dorothy and I really want to spoil, we go there at four people, you're looking at like $500. But you won't complain because you knew going in that's what it was going to cost, and the service and the food are exceptional. Well, Tim created a dish, and it is based on a Scandinavian dish that is made with like lingonberries and chanterelle mushrooms and a reindeer loin that is a very traditional meal served around the holidays, like a banquet meal, like very high-end. And he did an Americanized version. I actually got to meet Tim, and I told him, I know what you did. And when I explained that I knew what he did, and that's what he based it on, he got a grin that, like, chefs wait to hear a customer tell them something like this. He told me I was the only person that ever told him. He said, maybe you're not the only person that figured it out. But he based it, he used an elk loin. Instead of lingonberries, he used candied grapes. And there's like some other, like a puree. And I don't remember what they do it with in Scandinavia, but he used salsify for the puree. And he made this incredible thing, maitake mushrooms in place of the chanterelles. And he does the chanterelles to the point where like the crisp is just so on fire, but yet it's not overdone where the whole thing's like a potato chip. It's got that lusciousness in it. And what Ken just described is exactly the way they do them there, and they are fantastic. If you do it at home, though, for a sauce, sage brown butter. There's something about that with a maitake that is glorious. It is absolutely fundamentally glorious, and it's so simple. Chop up some fresh sage, keep it aside. Look up, if you don't know how to make a brown butter, we did a whole show on sauces, right? But if you don't know how to make a brown butter sauce, it's super simple. Look up how to do it. And when it's done and you've killed the heat, just throw the fresh sage in it and mix it through and give it a couple minutes for the sage to permeate. How much? I don't know. How much do you want? Taste it. If it's not enough, add more. If it's too much, don't do that again. Add some more butter, right? Like, you know, go small and keep adding until you're there. I use probably like a half a handful of fine, like a julienne sliced fresh sage leaves in that. I don't think you use it. And a little bit of garlic, because why not? That, but don't cook it in that. Make that separate. Get the mushrooms. If you're making the same pan, get the mushrooms out, like he said. You want to saute them. You want them in a very little amount of fat, so that's not too much. The other thing, he was talking about different fats, like duck fat is fantastic, but he mentioned chicken fat, schmaltz. Most of you are not going to have easy access to duck fat unless you're buying it by the tub or something, and it can get expensive. Chicken fat is something we could all render ourselves. Most people use chicken frequently. I never buy chicken without the skin on. I don't care what I'm buying. I don't care about it. I could get skinless. I always skin. And I always render that skin out, and I always save that fat. And chicken fat is also glorious with that mushroom. All right, let's move on to my subject, because I got all caught up in the food, man, because I love cooking, like really great elevated food, man. I think everybody should learn to cook elevated food because you'll You'll keep more money and eat better. Okay. Let's talk about this super battery that exists but doesn't exist. So it's a nuclear battery, and it's made out of a radioactive isotope of nickel that has a 100-year half-life, and that means that its own decay is what powers the battery. So you take this nickel radioactive isotope, and you put it in a case, and as it breaks down, just its own breaking down produces a small amount of energy, and that energy then is transferred from the battery into the device. And so this is an always-on, and it will provide that same amount of power with these diamond semiconductors is what also is in this to create the surface area to kind of resist the power flow sufficient to give a constant flow of some small tiny amount of, you know, milliwatts of energy or whatever. And it will last 50 years, and at the end of 50 years it would need to be disposed of, but it never needs to be charged. And the whole angle that it's being hyped up with is that it is a, eventually we'll all have cell phones that last forever. And it's 100 microwatts. 100 microwatts is what it provides. And I'll just cut to the chase. The cost of producing 100 microwatts would be about $2,000 to make a battery like that. And the thing is, when I read several articles on it, it never mentioned for a heartbeat the cost. And again, this segment is more about how to use ChatGPT for fact-checking. And I know it's got bias, and it'll tell you Joe Biden is better than Donald Trump or whatever. I don't care. You need to know how to use the tool. So let me just kind of, again, go through it. Like, this is a nuclear battery you never have to charge. It sounds like science fiction, but it's real. And when I first passed this article across ChatGPT, basically what I got is it's real. It told me all the things about how it works. It found other sources and gave me those and all. And this is being made by China. So, of course, it was like, China's taking over the world again. We're so stupid. They have this radioactive nickel 63 as the isotope. And it converts nuclear decay into power using diamond semiconductors. Runs up to 50 years without charging. What can it do, though? And what can it do? The one they're making with this, you know, microwatts thing will power tiny stuff, sensors, maybe implants in the human body or something, possibly micro drones. Like these drones are talking about making our size like a mosquito or something like that. But what it really will probably be used for is long-term probes doing space exploration, because you could deploy something for 50 years with no power. The thing is that decay happens, so we're also limited by the speed of whatever like that probe is on. So you can't send something like to the edge of the solar system and then turn it on, and only then does it start using it, because the decay is happening. So you get 50 years out of it. It doesn't make enough phone to power to even do a phone or a laptop, the one they're making now. It's not even close. It's kind of like a nuclear trickle charger. So it's nuclear. Is it safe? It emits no external radiation. It's a very low amount of radiation in the first place. It's completely sealed. It has no explosion risks. It can't blow up. It's not going to cause China syndrome and melt the earth or some shit. It's totally safe for like specific high-end applications. But it probably shouldn't be in your back pocket in something that could be damaged, because if you did crack the housing, it would start weeping low-emission radiation. Over time, you know, it could do something like, you know, you could grow a third nut or something if you were keeping it in your front pocket, right? So you don't want that. It can't scale easily, and the materials are rare and very expensive. Again, it'd be good for maybe space missions, not smartphones. It's cool science, but don't believe the hype. But the price breakdown was the big thing. Like I said, this little one, $2,000. So you might be thinking, like, well, they make you make one for a cell phone for like $10,000, and that's, you know. Because when I said this on social media, it was, shut up, you don't know anything about economy of scale. I'm like, you don't know who you're talking to. See, what I want to know is not the cost of production. I want to know the cost of raw materials. Because one thing we can't do is just shit more nickel 63 or 13 or whatever the hell it is, right? Nickel 63. This is very rare, way more rare than gold. So this is where it turned around to me using ChatGPT in a way that actually let me debunk the hype, because the articles never made the case for the hype. They just said, here's what the thing is and what it does, but they didn't tell you anything about the cost. I couldn't find anything about the cost at all. What I was able to do is use ChatGPT to break down the materials and the material cost. You would need about 5 watts of output. 5 watts of output to power a smartphone, right? Not a laptop. You need way more than that to power a laptop. So a smartphone needs about five watts of output. So you need 50,000 times more power than the battery that's the size of a coin, which means the battery you would build would be bigger than a cell phone to build it this way, first of all, okay? But what would the cost be? Because the cost alone dictates whether this is doable or not. You would need 50 grams of nickel 63. And again, we just, like, nickel 63 is not something you can make a machine and just start chunking out pieces of it. It's $1 million a gram. That's $50 million. Now, your $10,000 estimate, you know, scaling this up from a $2,000 product for a cell phone, you would need diamond semiconductors. You'd need about $10,000 to buy the semiconductors. So to make one battery bigger than a cell phone, to power the cell phone for 50 years, you would need $50,010,000. This ain't happening. It's never happening. And, you know, I think using a charging cable and a wall outlet outweighs $50 million, no matter how much inflation we have. Like, I still, like, this is untenable. This will never work. This doesn't work. But my real lesson for you in this is how you use ChatGPT for fact-checking. You can't just say, is this real? You have to look at any, like, in this case, the most obvious thing to me anyway, when it was like, is the hype that people are hyping, and you know there are a bunch of know-nothings. If you ask them what nickel 63 is, they wouldn't know. If you ask them how much a gram of nickel 63 costs, they wouldn't know. And when you tell them this is probably not scalable to run your cell phone, they tell you you're stupid. But they don't have any reason to say that because they don't even know what they don't know. Right? So to me, the most obvious thing was, well, what is the cost? Because I noticed I read three different articles on this, and what was conspicuously absent from all three articles was the cost or the sale price. And I'm like, if you really had on the precipice of making a battery for a cell phone that will run a cell phone for 50 years, no cell phone's going to last 50 years in the first place, but if you were on the precipice of that, well, then how far away are you from something that would run, let's say, you know, a house for 50 years? This would be Nobel Prize. This would be like, this should be being run from the Smithsonian on. Everybody in science should be talking about this. And really, it's kind of a minor story. And in the minor story, there's no talk of sale price, market time, nothing like that. So the obvious place to go was cost. But that may not have been the case. See, to use ChatGPT or AI, any sort of AI, and in this case an LLM or large language model, in order to use it effectively, you have to actually be a thinking technician. There are so many things I'm able to do with it, and there's things that I can't do well with it because it's not there yet. So the key is learning what it can do. I'm not going to try to use a saw to put a nail into a board. I'm going to use a saw to cut a board. But like a master craftsman might use the same saw and make something so like some kind of, you know, walnut inlaid into maple or something that I can't even think of. But he's using the same tool. If you want to become good at using AI, you have to think and not expect AI to do the thinking for you. AI is your research tool. It's your idea sounding board. It can be a fact-checking tool, but it's only going to check the fact that you know to ask for. So think of it this way. Imagine you had like a weak form, not a weak form, just a limited form of mental telepathy capability, right? You're like a telepath, but you can't read minds in of itself. You can't like say, oh, he's thinking about the color blue, or she's thinking about buying a new pair of shoes, except if she's a woman, she probably is. That would just be, you know, basically a good guess, right, or a scam. Say things that are obvious and pretend you read somebody's mind. Let's say that what you could do is you were like a human lie detector. And not in the way that some people are trained to do this, where you can, you know, some people can still fool them. Like, let's say you literally had some sort of telekinetic power that when somebody said to you, I painted my car red, inside your mind you saw a brief flash of green if they were telling the truth and a brief flash of red if they were lying. And it was 100% accurate. Right, which ChatGPT isn't, but let's say that it was, right? Well, you still have to ask a question the right way and press for an answer that, like, it wouldn't work on a political answer because a political answer doesn't actually commit. This is how you have to look at ChatGPT. It is as a limiting function of what it can do, and it's only going to do what you ask of it, and it's going to actually do, like, this is the other problem. Remember we had the guest on this week that talked about building a $500 million side or $500,000 side hustle while still working a job. And he said when you start hiring labor, hire very cheap labor. Not just to save money, but because if you've never actually managed somebody, not inside a company before where there's a structure of the company, it's your own company. And you haven't built the structure yet. You're going to do a bad job managing. You're going to make mistakes. So you want your mistakes to be inexpensive. It's kind of the same thing. You have to build the skill set. Or the other way, another analogy that I've given is you go to the state fair or whatever, and you walk around, there's a guy barking a product. And here's an actual product that Dorothy and I purchased one time. It was a tile cutter. And he would make these like S-curve cuts in the tile and crack, and he's perfect. And like he's like, if you can draw it, you can cut it. And like it worked. And we watched him do it, and we watched another guy that was working, another salesman do it, and they had just done it a lot. We brought it home, and it did not work well for us. Well, we had to learn the skill. Just because you have the tool doesn't mean you have the skill. And no one questions this when the tool is something dead simple, like a piece of artist charcoal. Like, you don't say the artist charcoal sucks because you can't make a beautiful picture out of it, and another guy can. You say, I suck as an artist. But when somebody tries to sell you the tile cutting tool, you're like, well, it doesn't work. Because it does. Well, no, that person just knows how to use it, and you haven't developed skill yet. If you want to use AI, and you want to use AI effectively, you have to develop that skill set. Now, I'm actually thinking, and I wonder who would be interested in this, of putting together like a 60-day course on AI, very similar to what Josh Hale did, where every day you get a prompt, and you just enter it and run with it, and then we all talk to each other in a group. I don't feel like I'm ripping Josh off because I'm not going to go mainstream with it. It would be a very low-cost thing, and we'd probably use Telegram, and we'd create a group just for that, and I would do the same thing he did, though. I would drop a prompt every day, and then people would use the prompt as instructed and then report back and communicate with each other. I think we could learn a lot that way, and I would do it very different from what he did. I would want all the prompts to be very practical, down-to-earth, and not only make you better because you know how to do that, but by the time you're done with it, your skill set would really exponentially grow. I think this would actually be really easy to do, very low effort. Now, I am not even thinking about this from a standpoint of executing it until after the 12th next month when my book is released and that is done, because everything between now and then is keep the show running, get the book release done right, and go do Nicole's workshop. That's all I got in me until May the 12th, and probably more like May the 15th, right? May the 4th be with you. I'm going to go right past that without even noticing. But I think that would be a cool thing, and I think not only would all of you guys learn a lot from it, that I would learn a lot from interacting with you, and we might even create a whole new community of power users of AI. And that could be really cool. So if you're interested in that, let me know, because the more of you that say you are, the more likely I am to actually do it. TSPC in the subject line, email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, and say I'm in. And the price I'm thinking of for this is going to be like $20. I figure if you won't pay $20, you don't really want to do it, and you're probably not going to be an active participant. People value what they pay for. So if we could get, let's say, 50 people interacting with this, That would be really freaking cool. And then it's nobody can turn around and say, Jack, you're all about the money, because I can make more money than that in a lot of different ways that are a hell of a lot less stress for me to do. But I think that would be kind of cool, and I'm interested if anybody is interested in it. With that, let's go ahead and wrap up. Again, I do have the book, Laws of Life. It is on KDP. It has now been approved. KDP is the publishing by Amazon self-publishing platform. I have actually had a couple of people reach out and offer to do editorial reviews for me. One is Doc Bones and some other people. So I'll be adding that to the sales page for Amazon. A lot of people are asking about self-pre-ordering. I don't know why. The Amazon platform will not let me make the soft cover available for pre-order. It will let me make the Kindle available for pre-order, and it technically is, and you could find it, but if you want to do that and you're going to buy the Kindle only anyway, fine. I really want to sell a lot of copies of the soft cover, and I want to put them in other people's hands. That's why I came up with the Ambassador Program. You should go to the site, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and look for the post, Laws of Life is Coming, and learn about the Ambassador Program. A lot of people have signed up for it already, and the ambassador positions are going away. And it is basically, at one level or another, buying a copy from yourself and buying a copy for others, and sharing the message of the show. And I know it's a big ask, but it would be really helpful, and it would be a way to help spread the message that we talk about here. The book itself is about building a solid life. It's about lifestyle design. It is really not a prepping book, though prepping comes into it a few places. It's not a political book, though some politics, show through. It is semi-autobiographical. There's a lot of my story in it, but it's not about me. It's about the laws of life that I built my success on. And I really, I had so many people telling me for so many years to write a book, and everybody wanted me to write a book either on permaculture or modern survivalism. And I'm like, there's so much on that. There's not a lot new for that. But what I wanted my whole life, it didn't matter what I built my success on, I wanted success. I wanted what I have had for the last 17 years because of this audience. I wanted the ability to live my life on my terms and not worry about money. Not be rich, but just not worry about money. I wanted to be able to not go to an office. I wanted to be able to not be somebody else's servant. And now I'm a servant to like a couple hundred thousand people, and I'm okay with it that way. But I didn't want to have to ask if it was okay if I took vacation in this August, 6 months in advance, and then have to hope my boss said yes. I wanted more. I came from dog shit, guys. I really did. Someday maybe I'll tell you exactly how far down the hole I was as a kid trying to figure out what I wanted in my life. But I knew one thing. I wanted more. And one thing that never worked on me was class warfare. And the reason it never worked on me was they said, but the rich people, like, but I want to be that person one day, and I know I can. And I didn't really think, well, I'll be rich, but I will be successful. Maybe I won't be rich, but I'll be wealthy. And in my life, I adopted certain philosophies, certain rules. And eventually I started to call them Jack's Laws. And people thought that meant that I came up with them. Some I did, but most of them were other places I gathered these things. But I said, this thing is so pure. This is so real. This is so honest. I am going to base my life on this. And I did. And this is the result. And the result isn't because Jack's super smart. It's because it works. You could be an idiot, and if somebody teaches you how to build a fire, and you do exactly what you're supposed to do, you get a fire. Well, I don't know if you can be an idiot and build a truly successful life, but you can be an average person. You can be lazy on some levels if you'll do the things that really matter. You could be an innately flawed individual, but if you'll have the ethics and the morals and the fortitude to do the right thing for long enough in a smart way, and you will learn how to find the smart way in this book, you will be a success. And I am proof of it, not because I am smart, but because I am flawed. That's what this book is. This is my gift to those who want it. And that may only be a few hundred or a few thousand people. I may never be a big-time author. There never may be half a million copies of that in circulation. I don't care if it's one that it really turns around. It's worth it. It's worth all the effort that it took to put that book together. I'm sure it's still not perfect. It took so long to come out with it because I wanted it to be perfect. I finally realized it's never going to be. Let it be what it is. And if you want to help me share that message, I would really appreciate it. Again, the book is called Laws of Life. There will be an associated website with it. There will be bonus materials with it. It will be awesome. And all of the people that are in the ambassador program, you will be on that website listed with a link to a site of your choice. I don't know that it'll mean that much, but it means a lot to me. And I'll just say at this point, thank you to everyone. And when you get the book, assuming you do, please don't skip two things. Do not skip the dedication. There's a lot of people from this community and some you've never heard of in that dedication. I could not write, when I got done with the book, I'm like, I have to add a dedication. And do not skip the introduction. Those are two things that a lot of people skip in a book, don't hear, because they are a huge part of what the whole thing is really all about. With that, I will catch you guys next week. Tomorrow you'll get a Friday flashback. Thank you for tuning in today. Oh, wait, item of the day. Almost forgot. DeWalt is my favorite tool platform. And today I finally brought a review out for you of a product I've been using for well over a year. The DeWalt pruners. They're on the 20-volt platform. A lot of you guys are on that already. They're absolutely awesome. I went long there, so I'll just let it go with that. But you can check them out. They are the item of the day from tspaz.com. And when you shop there, you help us out no matter what you buy. Take care, guys. Again, I'll catch you next week with another new episode. And tomorrow we'll have a flashback.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.